President Obama and his team are also looking for common ground with Congress on how to revamp health care and how to proceed in Afghanistan. We spoke yesterday to the House Minority Leader, Republican John Boehner of Ohio, at his office in the Capitol. Mr. Boehner says he's concerned that the White House may switch priorities in Afghanistan from defeating the Taliban to focusing more on al-Qaeda.
Well, in March, the president laid out a clear strategy to prevent al-Qaeda and the Taliban from reestablishing safe havens in Afghanistan in order to plan and execute attacks on Americans. And now it appears that the president is reconsidering that strategy, and I have real concerns about that. He sent General McChrystal to Afghanistan to implement this new strategy. And if General McChrystal believes that without timely reinforcements, our efforts may end in failure, then we must act quickly to give him the resources he needs to achieve our goals.
The president has said that he wants to wait until parliamentary elections. Does that make sense to you?
My concern is that the longer we wait, the more jeopardy exists for the troops that we have there. Even if there is a decision to send more troops, it's going to take a substantial amount of time for those troops to be trained and to deploy into that theater. And we have to remember that in Afghanistan, we typically have to deal with a spring offensive. And I just believe that we need to make sure that we have the reinforcements there so that the troops that we have there are not in greater danger as a result of not having enough troops to protect each other.
Mr. Leader, let's move on to health care. I know that you have been concerned about legislation coming out of the committees in the House and Senate. Do you see anything on the horizon that Republicans might be able to support?
Well, I think Americans have spoken. They want reforms that lower cost, expand access, and improve quality. None of the Democrat bills that we've seen thus far do that. You know, they claim that their bill will lower cost by spending $1 trillion more, and Americans really aren't buying it. And so there are a number of things that Republicans believe are essential. We believe that making sure that people who have pre-existing conditions have access to affordable health insurance. We believe that if you lose your job, you shouldn't have to be worried about losing your health insurance, and you should be able to take your health insurance from job to job. Republicans believe that we ought to get rid of junk lawsuits get doctors back to practicing real medicine instead of all the defensive medicine that they've practiced today. Estimates are that we'd save over $100 billion a year just in that area. And so there are common sense reforms that we can put in place to make our current health care system work better for more people.
The president said in his address to Congress that he wants Republican participation, but he also said that he doesn't see any reason to sit down at the table with people who just want to kill health care reform.
Well, there's no debate here in Washington about the need to fix our current health care system. The American people know that it costs too much, and they also know that there's not equal access to high-quality, affordable health insurance. And so as we move ahead, I think that there is common ground. We can do it, but let's be honest. The president hasn't had the Republican leadership down to the White House since late April or early May. I sent the president a letter back in May outlining some of the things we'd like to do in health care and asking for a meeting. And I got a nice, polite letter back that said, basically, thank you, but we'll see you at the end of the process.
Thanks very much.
Linda, thank you.
Representative John Boehner, the House Minority Leader, speaking to us from his office in the Capitol. It's Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Linda Wertheimer.
And I'm Steve Inske. Good morning. A meeting on the world economy may be overshadowed today by talk of a nuclear program. Leaders of world economic powers are meeting today in Pittsburgh. Three of those leaders, including President Obama, are expected to make an announcement, which involves Iran. Their announcement suggests a growing consensus resolve to stopping Iran's nuclear program, the enrichment of uranium. NPR White House correspondent Scott Horsley is in Pittsburgh. He's covering this story. Scott, good morning.
Good to be with you, Steve.
And he's with us live. So what are you learning?
Well, just about 20 minutes from now, we expect President Obama, flanked by the leaders of Britain and France, to accuse Iran of operating a secret nuclear enrichment facility. Now, U.S. intelligence is said to have known about this facility for years, but it only became public once Iran learned that its secret was out and belatedly acknowledged the facility this week in a letter to the International Atomic Energy Agency.
And this seems rather significant, Scott, because of the timing here. We're just a few days away, anyway, from some October meetings which will focus on Iran's nuclear program. And here you have the leaders of three key nations apparently on the same page, accusing Iran of being deceptive.
That's right. And these leaders will use this disclosure to press their case that Iran must allow international inspectors to monitor its nuclear program. Of course, Iran has argued that it's enriching uranium for peaceful purposes to make electricity, but the U.S. and others are concerned that that nuclear material could be used for making weapons.
We're talking with NPR's Scott Horsley. He's in Pittsburgh, where world leaders are meeting today. It's the group of 20, the G20 nations, some of the world's largest economies, as well as large developing nations around the world. And of course, the primary purpose of this meeting is supposed to be economic. And I gather that these leaders, Scott, are thinking more about the future.
That's right. You know, this is the third time that the G20 has met since the financial crisis really hit bottom last year. And this time the crisis siege mentality has passed a little bit. They're more focused on how to prevent a repeat in the future and also how to put the world's economy on a more sustainable growth path. One of the biggest things they're going to be doing is looking at financial regulation. Robert Gibbs, the White House spokesman, says that's the most important task for these G20 leaders here. And Treasury Secretary Timothy Geithner says he expects world leaders will reach agreement at this summit, not only on how to harmonize international financial regulations, but also how quickly to do so.
These are both areas that have been that people have disagreed on in the past.
Well, that's right. There was concern on the part of some of the European countries who wanted a more severe crackdown on, for example, the pay of bankers. Some of those differences have apparently been smoothed over. And as I say, Secretary Geithner says he does expect that there will be an agreement announced at this summit before the pain of the crisis has passed and the sort of the momentum to do something about international financial regulation has ended.
Well, let's listen to a little bit of what Secretary Geithner's been saying.
We are not going to walk away from the greatest economic crisis since the Great Depression and leave unchanged and leave in place the tragic vulnerabilities that caused this crisis. I think we all recognize that we need to act before the memory of the crisis fades and before the impetus for reform recedes. And we're trying to bring greater urgency and commitment to the need to act together.
And Scott Horsley, there was some talk leading into the summit about how some Europeans wanted to crack down on bankers' paychecks. Any action there?
That's right. There will probably be an agreement on a system that would discourage banks from paying their leaders in a way that encourages excessive risk-taking, but not really hard caps that some of the Europeans had wanted.
A lot of news out of a summit in Pittsburgh where leaders of the world's 20 largest economies are meeting today. Scott, thanks very much for keeping us up on it.
You're welcome.
That's NPR Scott Horsley.
The wireless industry is gearing up for a fight over net neutrality. On Monday, FCC Chairman Julius Genachowski announced his support for the principle that different kinds of traffic should move across the Internet without discrimination. But he stunned the industry when he said net neutrality should also apply to wireless devices. Cell phone companies say their services are very different from the regular Internet, and they warn of dire consequences if they're held to the same standards. NPR's Martin Costi reports.
Have you ever wanted to watch TV on your iPhone? There's an app for that. Just don't try using it on the iPhone's AT&T network.
The fact is that an application like that is one that consumes a lot of capacity.
Mark Siegel is a spokesman for AT&T, which recently barred iPhone users from using Slingbox, a service that can redirect home TV service to handhelds. The app may be way cool, but Siegel says there are practical considerations.
Wireless is fundamentally a shared resource. So if you have a wireless tower in your area, the people in that area that have your service are contending for that resource at any given time, we have to manage the traffic.
Manage the traffic. Those words are anathema to someone like Rob Topolsky. He's the guy who first discovered that Comcast was blocking or slowing down certain kinds of file sharing on the regular internet.
That's my claim to eternal geekdom.
Topolsky's discovery added momentum to the net neutrality movement. Today, he works for the New America Foundation, a D.C. think tank, and he favors extending neutrality to wireless.
The internet is a defined thing. It's a set of standards and a set of expectations of operations that the wireless service providers, as members of the internet community, are expected to adhere to.
It's a popular sentiment. Some call it technopopulism. But Chris Gutman-McCabe, vice president of CTIA, the Wireless Industries Association, warns that it could lead to unintended consequences.
A YouTube download takes 100 times the bandwidth of a voice call. So that gives you a sense of sort of this impending perfect storm that we're going to have on the broadband side.
The industry won't cite actual instances of applications causing outages on the networks. Right now, they talk only of potential problems. Net neutrality advocates point out that the carriers are strangely tolerant of some bandwidth hogs, YouTube, for instance, but not others, like Slingbox. Gutman-McCabe defends the carrier's right to make these decisions. He says it's a matter of fairness to the companies.
You don't see NPR being asked to carry advertisements for other radio station groups or programs.
He says the U.S. has one of the most competitive and innovative wireless industries in the world. But if the FCC starts enforcing neutrality, that might change. The industry has invested billions buying radio spectrum, and it'll need to spend billions more to keep expanding coverage and bandwidth. Neutrality regulations, he says, might have a chilling effect.
To be honest with you, from our perspective, it inserts more than a fair amount of uncertainty into the provision of service.
It's not yet clear how aggressive the FCC will be pushing neutrality onto the wireless networks. So far, the chairman has laid out only general principles, and he says he's willing to shape the rules to suit wireless companies' technical challenges. Martin Costi, NPR News.
After box office hits with Roger and Me, Fahrenheit 9/11, and Sicko, and an Oscar for Bowling for Columbine, Michael Moore returns with Capitalism, A Love Story, a critical look at the business of America, business. Film critic David Edelstein has this review.
Say what you will about Michael Moore. He's a successful left-wing carnival barker in a culture that mostly rewards right-wing carnival barkers. Yes, he's been caught fudging facts, but he doesn't just spew partisan talking points. He's out there, on the street, amassing evidence. His new cinematic circus, Capitalism, A Love Story, is the film he's been building to for two decades. It's sprawling, scattershot, and sniggering. It's brazenly one-sided. Yet it's riveting. His other films focused on symptoms. This one tackles what he sees as the disease. Let's start with his conclusion. Quote, "Capitalism is an evil, and you cannot regulate evil." That's enough to give anyone pause, especially in light of the sorry history of other political and economic systems. He has a less controversial case when he attacks those who portray the connection between capitalism and democracy as sibling close, united under the umbrella of the Constitution. One of Moore's stunts is a trip to the Capitol Rotunda to examine the document. After a Wall Street Journal editor tells Moore that capitalism is more important than democracy, the filmmaker quotes the Founding Fathers on the dangers to democracy of an unregulated market. He also has Jesus on the record denouncing material wealth. As usual, Moore scores most points with satire. He redubs an old Bible movie so that Jesus refuses to heal a cripple because of a, quote, pre-existing condition. I wouldn't use the term documentary to describe this film. It's a barbed comic monologue with big jolts of pathos. Moore uses a daddy-knows-best tone, borrowed from 50s documentaries. This, kiddies, is how our society really works. Some people hate that condescending tone, but I like it. I think it's apt. Moore is a kind of Mr. Rogers with 200 extra pounds and a Che Guevara t-shirt instead of a cardigan. As for content, Moore ranges far and wide, although rarely very deep. He begins with foreclosures on poor people and gives a quick sketch of predatory lending. He draws comparisons between the fall of the Roman Empire and our American century. He makes the case that Ronald Reagan and his corporate allies began dismantling regulations in a way that amounted to a coup d'etat.
See that guy standing next to the president? You know, the one that looks like a butler? His name was Don Regan, the chairman of Merrill Lynch, the richest and biggest retail brokerage firm in the world. He took the key position of Treasury Secretary so he could enact the tax cuts that the rich wanted. Regan then became White House Chief of Staff as the president started to fade.
Then they should give the president what 43 governors have, a line item veto. And
Who tells the president to speed it up? The man from Merrill Lynch, that's who. Things in America would never be the same again. The country would now be run like a corporation.
We're going to turn the bull loose.
It got worse, says Moore, under George W. Bush, who took a chainsaw to Wall Street regulations. That's not my metaphor, or Moore's. Bush officials and lobbyists posed with a chainsaw for a magazine cover, setting the stage for what Moore calls the greatest wave of white-collar crime in American history. He doesn't exempt Democrats either. Bill Clinton also unleashes the Wall Street bull. But while Moore rejoices at the triumph of democracy he says was Obama's election, he doesn't note the bailout goes on unabated. Among Moore's more appalling segments is one in which he recounts instances in which for-profit businessmen assumed roles traditionally played by government, like the private Wilkes-Barre, Pennsylvania juvenile correction facility that allegedly paid millions in kickbacks to judges who'd put away teens for minor infractions. Moore makes one detour that's exploitive. After a segment on blue-chip companies that earn millions secretly taking out life insurance policies on employees, he introduces a family in which the mother, a Walmart worker, died of an asthma attack, and the company collected $80,000. The children read "We miss you" letters to their dead mom and weep. But what's the context? She wasn't failed by the health care system. He moves in on the crying kids like a ghoul. In the final sequence, Moore pretends to try to make citizens' arrests on Wall Street and puts crime scene tape around the stock exchange. On one level, groan. On another, no one else seems about to make arrests. Maybe the image of Michael Moore as sheriff would scare Wall Street straight.
David Edelstein is film critic for New York Magazine. You can download podcasts of our show at freshair.npr.org. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our engineer is Audrey Bentham, with additional engineering support from Joyce Lieberman and Julian Hirschfeld. Dorothy Farabee is our administrative assistant. Sue Spolin directed the show. Our theme music was composed by Joel Forrester and performed by the Microscopic Septet. For Terry Gross, I'm David Bianculli.
StoryCorps is collecting stories from people around the country, and the project is launching a new initiative to hear from Latinos. It's called StoryCorps Historias, which in Spanish means both story and history. Today we hear from Jose Cruz and his daughter Grace. Jose grew up in the Dominican Republic. In the late 1950s, his mother left their home to find work in the U.S., and he tells Grace his mom's departure was hard to take because she'd been so much a part of their life in the neighborhood of Villa Juana.
My mother told me that I was the cutest thing in Villa Juana. She called me Chichi. She said, Chichi, tú eres lo más lindo de Villa Juana. And she would give me a big kiss. And I would go to school with this big stamp of red lipstick on my forehead. So she built a self-confidence in me that no one could ever, like, take away. I was 6 years old when she left for New York City. And I remember my uncle said, you're going to cry when your mom leaves. And I said, I'm not going to cry, but I think I've been crying ever since. My mother wrote often about what she was experiencing here in New York City. And as a child, I used to look at those postcards my mother would send. Mm-hmm. I always imagined that I would live in those postcards. So when I heard that I was coming to New York, I was in seventh grade, and I thought I was going to be living in the Empire State Building. But we lived in West Harlem. And instead of living in the Empire State Building, we lived in a basement with the front windows looking into a space where people put their garbage. But at the same time, I finally was living with my mother, and I felt so good. I would say that, without a doubt, she has been the most influential person in my life.
Based on that, are there any words of wisdom you'd like to pass along?
Well, I would just say something that my mother told me once. She said, you know, Chichi, I don't want you to be the smartest kid. Just do your best, and I will always be proud of you, and I will always love you.
Thank you.
Wow, Grace, I am so happy that we have been able to have this conversation.
Thank you.
Be beautiful.
Jose Cruz with his daughter Grace in New York City. Their conversation will be archived with all the others at the Library of Congress. You can subscribe to the project's podcast at npr.org.
From NPR News, this is All Things Considered. I'm Madeline Brand.
And I'm Robert Siegel. In the world of high school football, there are small town teams, and then there are the Burnt River Bulls from Unity, Oregon.
We've had eight on our team all year.
And this is eight-man football?
Yes, that's correct.
So that means every guy is playing every down of every game?
Yes.
That's Burnt River coach Wayne Wise with NPR's Tom Goldman. And numbers aren't the only challenge facing Wise this season. There's also the fact that most of his players are still trying to figure out the basics of the game. Today, as part of our high school football series, Friday Night Lives, the improbable story of the Burnt River Bulls.
Meet the team. Caleb Andrews, fullback, Hereford, Oregon. Justice Wise, halfback, Hereford, Oregon. So much for the easy part of the lineup.
Uchkunulu Kanvakai, left guard from Kyrgyzstan.
Su Siyao, quarterback from Taiwan.
Jovan Radakovic, left end, Serbia.
Chu Hyung Park, right end from South Korea.
Jemel Rokdu, right guard, Bremen, Germany.
Ban Du, center from China.
Six exchange students have turned the Burnt River Bulls into a virtual UN in helmets and pads. These 15 to 17-year-olds plopped down in the eastern Oregon town of Unity, population about 120, for a crash course in rural America. Like a lot of remote areas, Unity brings in exchange students to increase funding for schools and for the cultural give and take with the locals. For the new boys, it's also been a crash course in a sport they had never played.
Okay, that looks pretty good. Looks a lot better than yesterday. Really good.
Better than yesterday. That could be a nice slogan for this team. The initial yesterdays were brutal. None more so, says coach Wayne Wise, than the Bulls' High Desert League opener.
They didn't know what to expect the first game. Their mouths dropped open, and me and Titus both tried to explain to them that they were going to get hit or hit somebody every play. They weren't going to be up against the blue blocking dummy. And they just didn't believe it, I guess, until the whistle blew.
It blew for the last time at the end of the third quarter when officials stopped the game. Burnt River trailed 50-6. The Bulls, exhausted and aching, were down to five players. This week, practicing amidst sprinklers will work around them, Coach Wise said. The Bulls ran some offensive plays against no defense. That's all they can do with now nine players. They added a new guy this week.
Châu Nguyễn Anh Tuấn, guard from Vietnam.
At times, they look like a real football team, though it's safe to say they haven't mastered the basics yet. Here, Justice Wise, the coach's son, tries to make sure everyone in the huddle understands the play will start when he shouts out the second hut.
32.
Okay.
On 2.
Okay.
On 2.
Guys, on 2. On 2. You know what that means?
Yes, on 2, yeah. All
right, remember, ready? Break!
They leave the huddle and set the play, with Wise still not sure that Chinese center Ban Du knows when to hike the ball.
Down! Remember the count. Set! Hut!
Oh!
Yeah, offside!
I said remember the count.
And push-ups!
Ban Du forgot, but says Coach Wise, that's what practice is for.
Congratulations!
Congratulations. How many?
Four, five.
There is practice after practice. Back at the boys' dorm, a few hundred yards from the football field, they do their English language drilling with dorm mother Darla Derrick. For several, including Ju-young Park from South Korea, English is the toughest part of football, even more than hitting.
Almost I can't understand what they say, the coach say and Caleb say. So I don't know what should I do. So I embarrassed.
A lot less, though, after last Friday. Way ahead of schedule, the Bulls won. They beat a team with 19 players, 14 of them exchange students, 24-0. Wayne Wise, a perfect match for this team because he's never coached football before this year, called the turnaround amazing. Ban Du put victory into a Chinese context.
We are together. We are like a many chopstick together. Nobody can break it. So we are 8 people, beat the whole team, so I think very proud of us.
Coach Wayne Wise says at season's end, the Bulls won't be collecting any trophies, which is why he wants them to have fun and be competitive. With the numbers of kids dwindling in the already tiny town, this could be the last year for football in Unity. If so, what a way to go out. Tom Goldman, NPR News.